Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob, and you're at the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Sometimes you just have a gut feel of what's right and what's wrong. In California, passed the three strikes and you're outlaw, and something told me that that was wrong because it should be one strike and you're out. Well, at any rate, years ago in Denver, there was a criminal on trial. He'd be put away for a long time, and from within jail, he ordered a hit on somebody, and that hit was executed. It was a rather horrifying moment in Denver's history, and I have online someone to help me tell the story. It's our friend, longtime friend of Bob and Yurt Live, Steve Curtis. Steve, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Bob. Good to be here.
It's great to have you on. Steve, people know you because you're a pro-life activist, and you are the founder of LifeCommercials.com, and we talk about you guys quite often. You have a banquet coming up soon on April 21st, and I'll be going to that. But I asked you to come on the show so we could talk about the crime that happened to you quite a few years ago now and draw some lessons from it.
It's hard to believe it's been this long. It was June 6th of
1989.
And your setup was right. There was a habitual criminal, a guy named Roger Young, who had been in jail a couple of times, or not just jail, but prison, a couple of times before. And in late 1988, he and a few other guys, four of them total, decided to rob a place called the Parkside Cafe. It was on the west side of City Park in Denver. It's now a La Peeps restaurant. And late one night, about 10 o'clock, as the place was closing up, and the bartender, who was female, and a guy named Frank Magnuson, was a friend of mine, were walking out to her car. They were accosted by these four masked gunmen who tried to force them back into the Parkside Cafe to get the day's receipts. Well, a scuffle ensued, and these guys split up. Somebody from across the alley saw what was going on. The girl yelled. This guy yelled at them. I guess there was some Marine across the alley there, and he decides he's going to come down there and take care of this situation. But,
right.
Well, long story short, a few minutes later, after the police had been called, they got the description, and they didn't find three of the guys, but they did find the fourth one. Ends up being this Roger Young, and he was several blocks away. He had stolen somebody's bicycle and was trying to make his way out of the neighborhood. And so anyway, Roger Young goes back to jail. He is going to stand trial, and you know how long that takes. It's 9 months later now, in June of 1989. He's going to jail, and going to trial, and the DA had already announced that because of the types of crimes he had done, they were going to go for the habitual criminal statute, which is very much like the three strikes, you're out. They finally had decided that this was enough for this guy. He was a violent criminal, and they didn't put him away for long enough the first time or the second time, so this time they were finally going to do it. Well, he's sitting in jail, and you know, he's not all that dumb. He can figure out from jail that if he is living in a state like Colorado that does not use the death penalty, that it's really just kind of a hollow threat. And if he's sitting there looking at the habitual criminal statute and he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison anyway,
he might as well do whatever he could to try to escape conviction.
Right. It actually put him in an everything to gain, nothing to lose situation by killing the only witness to his crime, who was Frank Magnuson.
Magnuson. All right.
Who by this time was my roommate.
Okay.
So they decided he hatched out a series of plans, actually, but the one that finally came to fruition was the one that, as you so eloquently put it, was executed on June 6th of 1989. On that evening, myself and a friend had been out and with another friend, and we had already dropped her off back at her apartment, and my friend was coming back into my house with me, and Frank hadn't been home for about 3 days because he had been threatened by these people that he better not testify or else.
Wow.
He had talked to the district attorney about that, and the district attorney said, oh, don't worry about that, you know, that's just all talk, these things don't really happen, which at that time was true. Now, we know since then there have been about a half a dozen of these witness killings in Colorado, but Frank Magnuson back in 1989, so far as we know, was the first the first prosecution witness ever killed to prevent his testimony. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at that time, what the DA said was pretty much the common knowledge, and it was true.
But what was different was we had this habitual criminal statute that actually motivates criminals in the wrong way. But go ahead.
Well, yeah, and it actually did, and that's something that we, you know, that we really need to think about. It's, you know, when we look at the legislative process and people constantly just down there churning out new law after new law after new law, we really have to start thinking about what are we really doing here. I mean, habitual
right.
criminal statute is not much of a deterrent for somebody that's as comfortable in jail as he is out. I mean, some of these guys spend the bulk of their life in jail. That really is home to them. And so it's really not much of a threat, but of course they'd rather be out. And if they can get away with something like this, and history would tell them that they could, because what, Colorado has executed one person now since 1967.
Yeah, I mean, 40 years, it's a joke. And Steve, that's one reason why we pray for gridlock, typically here at Bob and Your Live. We pray for gridlock, that our legislators can't agree on anything, and so they don't do anything, because the more they do, the worse things are.
Well, it's typical. Yeah, it's typical, and we just see it all the time. I mean, I was just laughing the other day about something that I heard some legislator in Colorado here trying to do. I don't even remember what it was. I said, oh, my gosh, it just gets worse. Just when you think it can't, it does. But
right.
anyway, back to the story.
Yeah.
We came into the House that night, and this is a little after 11:30 p.m., and even as we were coming up the back, you know, through the backyard to the back door of the house, I started noticing that something was different. The backyard light was turned off. Leaving for the night, I had turned it on before I left, and then I thought, well, my roommate must have come home. You know, Frank must have come home and turned it off. Well, when I went to get the door then, the door was deadbolted. And that was a door that, you know, you had to have the key on either side of the door. I said, well, now that doesn't make any sense, because he certainly wouldn't have deadbolted himself inside the house, or at least I thought. And then I walked into the house and walked up a couple of stairs, and I saw a plant that was there that was fine just a couple hours before, and it had a big leaf that had been cut off and had fallen to the ground. I saw a blind that was up, had been let down, you know, a shade. So there were suddenly a lot of things in just a few seconds, and I turned to say to my friend Dan, who came in with me, I said, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff going on around here. And at that moment, we heard a commotion behind us, and a couple of guys with guns ran up from the basement, which effectively blocked off the back door, and the only other escape out of the house would have been the front door, which, living on a busy street as we did at that time, was also deadbolted, and you would have needed a key. So we were trapped. We were trapped in this small house with these two guys who were yelling all kinds of profanities. They both had hats on, masks, so all we could see was their eyes. They both had guns. We were in a very small area, you know, less than probably 50 square feet. There were four of us in this tiny little area, and one guy pointed the gun right at my face and pulled the trigger, and it just went click. As he had run up the stairs, I saw something shiny fly out of that gun, and as it turned out, he had kind of a nervous habit, and he had a 9mm semi-automatic, and he was playing with the slide, and he ejected the bullet that was in the chamber,
right.
And another one didn't go in, and
okay.
And so when he pointed the gun at my face and pulled the trigger, it just went click.
Huh.
There was no bullet in the chamber, and he looked me right in the eye, and he says, "That must have been God, because I just tried to kill you."
Whoa.
This is really a bizarre thing for a
right.
guy that's a murderer to say to
Hey, Steve,
you know,
I've had 6 months of prison jail ministry.
Right.
And it's astounding how many people in jail are Christian or claim to be Christian or DUIs or beat their wives. And they've actually have gone to church and they don't understand why God has ordained all these evil things to happen to them. And so we tell them, it's not God, it's you. You're a sinner,
yeah.
You're evil.
Yeah, don't blame God, man. Take some responsibility.
Yeah, but, right. So,
yeah,
okay, so this guy thinks that God saved you. He forgot he ejected the, but okay, go ahead.
Well, yeah, but you know, and at that point, because, you know, I really didn't put, I'll be honest with you, I didn't know how a how a semi-auto worked at the time. That's the first 9mm semi-auto I'd ever seen in my life. So when I saw something fly out of it, at the time, you know, of course, this is all happening in
yes.
fractions of seconds.
Right.
And, of course, there's the adrenaline rush, you know, and the initial shock of having guns pointed at your face and all that. But I said to him, I said, that was God. Well, now the other guy that was with him, the bigger of the two, he gets all freaked out and starts his profane, you know, profanity again, and they're basically asking us which one is Frank. They were looking for Frank, who was going to testify the next day against, as it turns out, the big guy's brother was Roger Young. This was Joe Young and Kevin Fears were the two guys in my house.
Kevin Fears. Haven't heard
Kevin
that name
Fears.
In a long time. Okay.
Yeah, what a name, you know.
Yeah.
And as we find out years later that Kevin Fears had actually gone to the Christian school at the church that I went to for 16 years growing up.
Wow.
I never knew him. He was about 9 years younger than me because I was 29 when this happened, and they were both 20. But anyway, a lot of stuff ensued over the next 15, 20, 30 minutes, and most of it was them trying to beat out beat information out of us. They hit me with a chair. At one point, I had gotten up and backed the big guy into a corner, and I was yelling at him, in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, put those guns down and get out of this house. And it just freaked him out. Every time I would use the Lord's name, it just physically freaked this guy out. And he would back off, even though he was holding a loaded .357 and pointing it right at me. Mm. At that point, he backed into a corner. The other guy came out. Fears came out of a bedroom that he was in there milling around in, and Joe Young says to him, hit him with something. So he picked up a cordless telephone, which, as you'll remember, back in 1989, these things weighed about 2.5 pounds, and smashed it over my head and shattered it. And so now the blood's flowing, and I'm falling to the ground and pretty dizzy at that point. So I decided that didn't work too well. So I decided to change tactics. And, you know, Bob, as I was just over the next 15, 20 minutes trying to, you know, figure out something to do here. I was trying to, and Fears would go out of the room. I would try to get Joe Young to turn around because I knew that he was standing right next to a drawer full of kitchen knives. Mm. And I thought if he would just turn around, I could jump up, I could push him out of the way, open that drawer, grab a knife, and stab him.
Mm-hmm.
I was angry that they were in the house. And,
sure.
And
self-defense.
Right. Well, it would have been, and it probably would have ended up in me dying or something. But at that point, you're kind of like, so what? I was now in that same situation, you know, everything to gain, nothing to lose, because they had told us, you know, we're not here to talk to you. We're here to kill you. Yeah. They had made a phone call at one point and called Roger Young's girlfriend at the time, later became his wife, because they thought that that would prevent her from testifying against him. She was the one that was setting up the phone calls with Roger Young in jail. And they called her and said, you know, Frank's not here. We've got these other two guys. What do we do? And they said, you know, she just said, look, you know, if he's not there by midnight, shoot those two and leave. And that's what they told us. When they hung up with her, they said, if Frank's not here by midnight, we're going to shoot the two of you and leave. And at that point, I looked right past Joe Young's head. I was on the ground and looking up, and just past his head, there was a clock on the wall, and it was 10 minutes to midnight. So I knew that there were about 10 minutes left, and in that 10 minutes, I would have to do something. And I'll tell you, you know, while trying to get him to turn around and all that wasn't really working, quietly to myself, I was speaking in tongues. I was thanking God for delivering me. And I really did have, by that point, a calm. You know, the initial shock had worn off, and I really had a calmness. I knew I was going to get shot. There was no question in my mind I was going to get shot. I don't think for a second I believed that they could actually kill me.
Mm.
And that was just that was just the comfort, you know, of knowing some scripture. And I had, you know, the verse, greater is he that is in you than he that is, you know, in the world. And that and a few others were just going through my mind, and it was just very comforting. Well, interesting that as Krista Schaefer and Roger Young later get married, thinking that, you know, she won't have to testify against him if she's his spouse, well, she did have to testify against him, and he from jail again after all of this. has her shot. She opens up the door one night. One of Roger's buddy puts 5 bullets in her.
Mm.
You know, this was a couple of years later. So even
right.
even
and this,
this
is why we say
a,
one strike and you're out, not 3 strikes.
Oh, yeah, it has to be. I mean, you know, the system continued to fail because, you know, at midnight they did. They shot me twice in the head. They stepped over me.
Wow.
They shot my friend Dan twice in the head.
Wow.
And on the way out the door, they saw Frank coming up the back walk there. They crouched behind that, and as his key went into the lock, they threw open the door. They shot him twice through the glass, you know, security door. And then as he fell in the backyard, they shot him twice more and killed him.
Oh,
Dan died almost immediately. Frank died immediately. I laid there for a couple of minutes, and after I was certain that they were gone, I got up and went and found a phone that hadn't been broken over my head and called the police, and then I called my mom and dad because I certainly didn't want them getting the call from the police, and waited basically for the police to show up, which actually took a second 911 call because they didn't come after the first one. They said I was so calm on the phone that they didn't believe that this had actually happened. And when I called the second time, the operator actually started to read me the riot act and said, you know, sir, this isn't funny. Do you know these calls are being taped? And in a not in a very Christian-like way, I told her she better get somebody there quickly.
Right.
Finally, the cops arrived. So here is what Joe Young and Kevin Fierce think is a triple homicide. I mean, they left. They had shot all three of us in the head. They thought that we were all dead. Well, obviously, I wasn't. I was rushed down to Denver General Hospital and got in there. And when I first walked in, I think they all thought that I was, you know, it was just a matter of minutes until I was dead. I was completely covered in blood. And once they started to clean up, they found that the first bullet had hit my head and literally ricocheted off.
Wow.
The second one went into the back, hit my skull, didn't penetrate it, skidded along the skull for about 4.5 inches, came back out towards the front of my hairline, and then into the back of my arm and out the front of my arm, and then through the floor.
Hey, Steve, now, you, over the years, once in a while, I've had opportunity to tell you I thought you were a little hard-headed. But this is a case where it saved your life.
Yeah, it's a little bit extreme, isn't it? You know what? You know, funny thing about that, Bob. My mom and dad came down to the hospital, and I was already sitting up in the emergency room, and I didn't even know at that point that I had been shot in the head because I literally, you know, couldn't feel much of anything at that point. Talk about an Excedrin headache the next day. But at that point, I really wasn't feeling much of anything.
Wow.
And my dad walked in, and I was kind of laughing because they had just put a like an irrigation tube in the back of my arm, and water was squirting out the hole in the front of the arm as they were cleaning out the bullet the bullet hole. And my dad walked in because he's kind of known to be hard-headed, and I told him, you know, he didn't have anything to worry about if he were ever to be shot in the head. So
right.
You know, it did kind of become a family joke, but
yeah.
it was that instance that really started, you know, and this is way back in 1989, and it's something a little different back then. We never did talk to the press. You know, when this stuff happens today, you know, family members and their representatives, and everybody's got a representative, and everybody's talking to the press. We were told right from the beginning, the cops said, look, you know, you can talk to the press if you want. We can't, you know, we can't tell you what to do, but we really would prefer that you didn't, and we did not.
Mm.
In fact, I think I gave my first press interview in 1994, almost 5 years later.
All right.
So, and of course,
and by the way, that's when Steve
was your show. So.
Hey, Steve, right. But I was just going to say, we were on TV at the time.
You were on TV. We did TV and radio, and I think we did them both in the same day, if I remember right.
Yeah, I think you're right.
TV up in, radio up in northern Colorado that afternoon, and then back down to the south end of Denver for television that night.
Bob, and you're live on Channel 53. That's right.
Right.
Now, I don't recall if we were on satellite and around the country, if we had been syndicated yet, but I think we may have been.
And I don't remember.
Okay. So where do we go from here? You survived. You ended up testifying against these guys.
Well, yeah, we had some really, really crazy stuff going on in the trial. In fact, the first Fierce trial mistried after about 7.5 weeks because we had a liberal judge that just let the defense get away with so much stuff. And in fact, jurors were going home at night, getting threatening phone calls at midnight. They would go out to their cars after a day-long, day sitting in court, listening to all this testimony and this double homicide trial, and gang members would be sitting on their cars and staring at them and just being intimidating. And it was just ridiculous. By the seventh week, we did not have enough jurors to continue the trial because we had already gone through a couple of the regulars and a couple of the alternates, and we no longer had 12 Wow. people. So we had to retry Kevin Fierce a second time. I did testify in Roger Young's trial for the Parkside. The judge let all my testimony in, even though it was all hearsay, about what Frank Magnuson had told me about the Parkside incident. And right. I remember distinctly when the defense attorney objected to my hearsay testimony, the judge said, "I'm going to allow it. The only reason we're having hearsay testimony is because your client murdered the guy that was supposed to testify." Mm-hmm. Now, it just so there are some tough judges, and then there are some that just don't quite get why they're there. But we finally did get Kevin Fierce convicted, 27 felonies convictions in less than 90 minutes of deliberation. Mm-hmm. But then the jury hung on the death penalty, went 6-6 on the death penalty.
Unbelievable, huh?
Yeah, just couldn't, had no problem at all convicting this guy of murdering two people and attempting to kill a third person, found all kinds of aggravating circumstances which you need in order to get the death penalty. Apparently killing somebody isn't enough. It's kind of like hate crimes laws, you know.
Yeah, right.
Beating up somebody's not bad enough, but call them a name while you do it, and you're really going to,
murdering someone.
Have the book thrown at you.
Yeah, murdering someone is aggravating enough for the death penalty.
Yeah, well, one of the aggravating circumstances in our case was kidnapping. Mm. When they moved us from the kitchen to the dining room, literally 2 feet against our will, that was kidnapping.
Sure. Same thing with rape, by the way. Rape is also inclusive of the crime of kidnapping.
Which
things are all capital crimes, but go ahead.
Yeah. So anyway, we get to the point of finally getting to the death penalty portion of this trial. And remember, we're over, we're like 4 years from the date that this thing happened, going on 5. We finally get this guy convicted, and then the jury just says, nope, life in prison.
Right.
And I'm thinking, this is exactly what Roger Young was looking at when he had witnesses killed, and it's just amazing that they couldn't put that together.
That the jury couldn't, right?
Half of them didn't.
Right, exactly.
But they bought into that whole thing that this is exactly what the defense attorney told them, that if you kill him, you're no better than he was when he did what he did to those two innocent guys.
Unbelievable.
And they believe it. People actually can't think enough for themselves where they can actually be duped like that, which is just amazing. But
now, Steve, we only have another couple minutes, and the story is so extraordinary. But you went on then, basically, to get a law passed in the state of Colorado.
Well, we got a few of them passed. We tried to get some stuff to beef up the death penalty and make it actually usable here. That kind of got mucked up and mired in the state legislature, and nothing ever happened. We did get a witness protection program. We did get some different sentencing. Judges now make that decision. Juries don't. We tried to get just the trial judge so that there could be some accountability in the sentencing. The governor at the time, Roy Romer, said he was going to go along with that. At the end, wouldn't. There ended up being a political compromise where now it takes 3 judges that don't even see the trial to make that decision, which doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Trust me, nobody's going to read the entire transcript of a 4-year murder trial. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
But we did get some things done, and that kind of launched me into politics, and I became the Denver County Republican chairman. I actually started that race when I wasn't even a Republican. My opponent was pretty quick to point that out, so I had to go down and register real quick.
And then, Steve, you became the chairman of the state Republican Party in Colorado.
Yeah, just a year later, became the chairman of the state party. And after doing that for a couple of terms and electing a bunch of Republicans and seeing how little that accomplishes, decided to do something legitimate with my time, and that's when I went on the board of Colorado Right to Life for 5.5 years, which eventually led Jim Anderson and I to form the Foundation for Life in Media.
That's right. And those in the audience, you guys are listening to Steve Curtis, who's been one of my heroes for many years here in Colorado, survived an attempt to kill him, and has since committed his life to saving the lives of the most innocent victims, children who are killed by Planned Parenthood, by abortionists, even complicity with their own mothers and often their fathers. And so, Steve, you guys have a banquet coming up April 21st.
We do, and that's at the Doubletree Denver North, which is at the Boulder Turnpike and Sheridan. And people can register at www.lifecommercials.com. Or in the Denver area, they can call 303-697-7825. Our speaker is Mona Sharon, and some people will remember her. She's written a couple of best-selling books, including one called Useful Idiots.
Mona Sharon is extremely well-known for many years. She's been in the pro-life battle, and she's a syndicated columnist. So, Steve, they can register. They could come out here. Mona Sharon, you'll be there, of course. I'll be there, and Ken and Joe Scott will be there. It's a special night for them because they are being honored that night.
Yeah, we're going to give them our annual Life Award, which honors people that just really don't ever get honored by the pro-life movement. You know, everybody I know that's really doing any work in this movement, nobody ever really thanks them. It's a thankless thing.
Steve,
if you're looking for accolades, go do something else. But if you're looking to get something, you know, fulfilling done, you get involved in the pro-life movement.
All right. Well, Steve Curtis, thank you so much, Steve, and we'll give that information out again.
Great. Thank
you, Bob. Appreciate your time. God bless you. And that's lifecommercials.com. You can register for the banquet online. You could call us here at Bob and Yart Live, 1-800-8-NYART. It's $50 a plate, 1-800-836-9278. Ken and Joe Scott will be there. I'll be there, Pastor Bob and Yart, Steve Curtis, whom you just heard, and Mona Sharon. So lifecommercials.com or call us. I want to tell you also, April 12th in Colorado Springs and April 25th at the Capitol. I'd like to see you there, too. And Maranatha Christian Center. Wow, what a great school in Arvada. Maranatha.